Hello and welcome back to The Correspondent, a podcast from the Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong. My name is Jared Watt, and you can probably figure out it's lunchtime and I'm at Bert's downstairs. Once again, you're listening to a special audio augmentation of an article in the print edition of the FCC's official magazine. And with me to get things moving in the right direction is Christina Panton. Welcome back to Bert's, Christina. Great to see you here.
Hey, Jared. Nice to see you again. And we are in Bert's, but sadly not eating lunch because we're doing this.
Indeed. You'll probably hear the coffee machine light up and chances are someone will start a game of pool here. But tell us what you got for us today.
As you know, in just a few months, the world will once again be focusing on the great sporting spectacle that is the Olympics. And this being the Club of Foreign Correspondents, so you're not going to hear us talk about the athletes today. We wanted to find out more about the other competition that happens at the same time as the Olympics. What's that? That's the competition between some of the world's best news photographers to get the best shots, using the latest technology sometimes, in combination with their best technical skills and that special mix of luck and know-how that puts them in the right place and the right time. And of course, there's also that global press pack of journalists, all trying to get the best quotes, the best access, and to find the hottest stories, and then hammering out those articles and getting them published first to get ahead of their competition. And we've got two people who have some considerable experience in this highly pressurized environment. Peter Parks is the chief photographer for the Hong Kong Bureau of the Agence France-Presse, otherwise known as the AFP. And he's also a correspondent governor here at the FCC. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Excellent.
We also have with us Josh Ball. He's the news editor for the sports desk of the South China Morning Post, our flagship newspaper here in Hong Kong. And he's covered sports all over the world, but lately has spent a lot of his time and effort, guess what, chasing up who is playing the correct national anthem at sporting events. Would that be a fair comment, Josh? What do you think?
Given where we are, no comment is probably the best comment, I would think.
You are one smart cookie. Well, gentlemen, thanks for sitting down to talk to me today. Now, interestingly, the two of you were at the 2008 Olympics in Beijing. So, can I get you both to unpack for us how covering the Olympics is so very different? And Peter, I'm going to start with you.
Okay.
As a photographer, how does your approach change when you cover the Olympics?
Well, actually, the Beijing 2008 Olympics was a little different for me because normally as photographers for agencies, we didn't get put on one sport for the whole event. So by the time you finished the Olympics, you're an absolute expert. But on this Olympics, I was actually what you'd call a fireman. So I would go to the MPC, the media center, every day, and wherever they were short of photographers or they needed some extra, I would be put on a different sport every day. So it was kind of nice. I didn't have to, you know, go through a whole 3 weeks of the Olympics in one event. I was running around all over the place, which is a very nice experience.
And Josh, you've been both a frontline reporter as well as a desk editor for the Olympics, and you covered the 2008 Olympics, but in a very different way from Peter. Can you just take us through that?
Yeah, so 2008, I was actually working in Bermuda for the Royal Gazette out there, and the Olympics obviously was a very different prospect for a small island with only a couple of athletes. So obviously Olympic gold medalist triathlete Flora Duffy, that was her first time. She didn't have a great time in Beijing, but that was her first time at the Olympics. So we were doing that. There were a couple of swimmers. Roy Allen Birch was one. So it's a very different experience doing it with a small contingent of athletes or a, you know, a small nation rather than some of the big nations that, you know, send out hundreds and thousands of people. So yeah, it was a different experience again from not actually being on the ground.
I love that because sometimes the small stories are actually big stories, and I love that it focused on a very particular place and a very particular athlete. So thanks for that. That's really great. And you know, it's not just about the moments of human achievement and celebration, as you both know. And Peter, you took a very important photo that showed the moment a Georgian athlete died on the luge track at the Vancouver Winter Olympics in 2010. Now, that was quite monumental. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was a tragedy, of course. It was the second death in an Olympics Games, summer or winter. And the first one happened in the 60s, I think, also on the luge. So it just shows what a dangerous sport it is. But what happened with Vancouver was it was actually quite warm in the daytime, and then overnight it froze. So early in the morning, the luge track became extremely fast because of the ice. And the athletes would go out around 7 or 8 in the morning. And this was a practice run. And my two other colleagues had gone down to Vancouver. I was up in Whistler. Gone down to Vancouver for the opening ceremony. So I was left on my own to shoot the training sessions in the morning. And just before this guy crashed, an Italian guy came off the track and luckily avoided any serious injury. But I noticed from his crash along the top where they came around for the final bend was extremely fast. So I moved up to the finish line, which was under a cover. And as this Georgian luger came round, he went way high. Then he corkscrewed round. And then he actually exited the track. And the cover, which was there to protect the ice in the sunshine, was held up by a 2-inch square metal pole. And unfortunately, he hit this pole coming out of the track backwards. I shot it on a fairly long lens, 300 mil. I ran down to see how he was. Paramedics were there immediately, but I could see he's probably already expired. They put a tube down his neck. His face was completely white, eyes glazed over. They resuscitated him. It was tragic. And I caught the whole moment. It's one of those times where you follow it through and you shoot. The camera shoots like 11 frames a second. You follow it through, you're shooting, but you don't really know. You're kind of in shock yourself, actually, because you just witnessed something pretty horrific. And then on the way down to the media center, you're running it and you go, I don't know if it's sharp, I don't know. You know, it's kind of almost a panic. You go, I don't know if it's really sharp. It could be completely not sharp and I missed everything. I got to the media center, downloaded my car, saw it was all sharp. And there was only 6 frames from when I started to when I finished when the guy hit the post, which means he was traveling some speed, because that's half a second of camera footage. And he traveled a long way. So I immediately sent the pictures down to Vancouver to our editing desk, and they put them out. And then it just blew up, you know, just huge news. I was actually just, everyone, I was sitting on my own in the media center, and people started hearing that I got these pictures and coming up to me and asking me, and then television crews were starting to come up and ask me. And I rang my boss in Vancouver and said, look, I'm getting hassled by the media here. He goes, oh, just go to your hotel, you know, don't talk to anyone, just go to your hotel, stay there. And then sure enough, from my hotel, I was watching CNN and BBC and they used the pictures that I took all over the world for this. All on CNN. The stills were coming up on CNN, BBC, everywhere. So, yeah, it was definitely a shocking moment, but a piece of history, and I was the only one there to get this.
It's amazing to be able to get a world exclusive from an event as big as this, but it just shows you the need to always stay prepared, because you don't know when the unexpected will happen.
Very true.
Exactly, and capturing that moment. That's an amazing story. Josh, I don't know whether there was any coverage on that. Do you remember that incident? And from your vantage point as an editor or reporter?
To be honest, because I was on a small tropical island in the middle of the Atlantic, the Winter Games didn't really feature very heavily for us. I should have been Jamaica, yes. But no, we kind of passed that one by, to be honest.
Okay, just curious. I didn't know whether there was another half to that story, but that's fine. Now, you know, we all talk about the Olympics pictures that capture our collective memory of really big events. And I was just leafing through some the other day. So, Josh, I'm wondering, do you have your own sporting highlights reel that kind of plays in your head, you know, things that you remember seeing that are just unforgettable memories?
Wow. There's been quite a few. Funnily enough, one of them wasn't when I was actually working. I was on a year out in Australia, and I was sat in a bar in Melbourne watching England win the World Cup in 2003. And so, you know, you're never going to get away from that memory of Wilkinson kicking a drop goal. That's never going to go away from your head. That was always there. A lot of cricket when I was young. I was very fortunate to go to quite a few test matches in the UK, so they're always on. From my working life, the America's Cup. I got a chance to watch the America's Cup in Bermuda. That was 2017, and being up close to that is very... That's a really intense experience, because you can take the boat right next to the course, so you're watching these F-45s fly around, and it's just I think any Formula One is always a really big experience.
Yep.
But then locally last year, a year ago today actually, when Tai Chi Ko won the World City Championship, the first Hong Kong player to win on the Asian Tour, was stood right next to the 18th green when he was putting to win. So I think, you know, those sorts of things, they're always going to stick with you. And it's like you said before, it doesn't have to be a major event, or, you know, relatively speaking, a major event. There's lots of things which stick with you. When I was a kid, I was in the crowd when there was a Liverpool striker called Ronnie Rosenthal missed the easiest goal of you'll ever see. It was an empty net. He was 12 yards away, and he managed to boot it against the crossbar or over, one of the two. But it's one of those things that they always play on highlight reels, and you'll always see it and always think about it. So, yeah, I think pictures and images are the things that stick, right? There are some words that stick, but when you immediately think of things, it's either the picture and the image or the commentary that goes along with it. And I think those are the things that always come to mind first. It's because I guess, you know, it's like the best, like those great headlines that you see, or the ones that really stick. So, you know, you can go back for commentary and pictures all the way back to, well, for me, obviously the 66 World Cup. They think it's all over, that line. You know, there's lots of them that stick out. So, yeah.
Well, they do tell a thousand words, as they say, so I'm not surprised that it's the images that stand out in your mind. But what a nice collection that is. You know, all kinds of sports, and it's stuff that reminds you of being there and witnessing something incredible, either incredibly bad or incredibly good. So thank you for sharing that. Now, I don't want to make all of us here feel too old, Jared included, but Peter, there are 18-year-olds out there walking around that with only a very passing knowledge, the skimpiest knowledge, of the 2008 Beijing Olympics. And maybe they can find some images and video online. What would you consider your top three moments and images from those games, and which athletes or events stood out to you?
Okay, so as I said before, I was covering a lot of different events. But the one event I did get to do was the beach volleyball, which you have visions of. I mean, it was in the middle of Beijing, of course. They built a beach. But you have visions of, you know, beautiful blue skies and kind of tropicalness. But, oh no, this was teeming down with rain. I mean, absolutely pouring down with rain, which actually made it quite a spectacle. So it was a very interesting way to shoot beach volleyball in a absolute rainstorm. I did shoot the tennis final. And from shooting Rafa Nadal before, I always knew if he won on the big stages, like Grand Slams, he always goes to ground. So I made sure on the last set that I went up to the top of the stadium, the very top. And sure enough, he went to ground right there, basically. So yeah, it was a great moment. He dropped his racket, got him falling all the way down, and it was a great moment, actually. You know, one of those pivotal, you know, Olympic yes, I did it moments. Because, you know, the tennis is as long as a Grand Slam, actually, in the Olympics. There's a lot of work. So but that was a very pivotal moment, too. But overall, I mean, the Beijing Olympics was fantastic. They did a great job with the organisation. It was the first time I think China had done such a massive event. And it was really well run. It was good fun. I mean, the camaraderie between, you know, you meet a lot of people you hadn't seen for a long time at these events, colleagues and from all over the world. And so the camaraderie, it's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun too. So yeah, I really enjoyed the Beijing Olympics. Really fantastic.
And the fact it's so vivid to you all these years later. I mean,
yeah,
it's a
long time now, which is scary.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah. I mean, you have a good memory, and you know they mm-hmm. stick because it was
yeah.
just such an amazing event.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I love that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn back to you, Josh, and no doubt you are doing some planning as to how the SCMP will be covering the upcoming Olympics.
Yes.
Can I ask you what changes you have seen in how events like these have been covered over the years, from maybe the first time you've done it or were sitting on a desk desking it to now?
Well, I mean, my first experience of a major event was the 2002 Commonwealth Games, when I was covering that as a junior reporter in Manchester, and the demand on your time was nothing compared to it is now, because obviously, you know, the internet websites for newspapers were still a relatively new thing, so you know, and I was working for an evening newspaper in the UK, so I would file my piece by 11 in the morning, and then everything else was then working for the following day. We would do some updating online, but not really. Whereas now, I mean, obviously the expectation is that you are covering an event 24 hours a day, right? I mean, what we're looking at for Paris is, with a 6-hour time difference, we're looking at, you know, that basically means that sometimes when Siobhan is swimming, when she's going to win gold, obviously, it's going to be 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. So we're going to have to work out how we staff that from here and from Paris. And so just looking at that roster now, and looking at those, just the organisation behind all of that is going to be a big thing, because, you know, we do live blogs, we have graphic departments, we're, you know, we'll obviously be on social media, and so you have to try and figure out what you can do and what you can't do. I think the biggest mistake you can make is trying to chase everything, because you can't cover everything. So we're going to have to be really dialed in on what we can do and what we have to then leave to some of the wire services to provide us, or the interns who will be flogged mercilessly for 2.5 weeks while they help us put stuff together, and they enjoy it.
God bless those interns.
No, absolutely, that's we've all done it. We've all been there, yeah. Right? So that's that's kind of how we're looking at Paris at the moment.
So no escape to a tropical island this time, hey?
No, sadly not. I mean, we've got the tropic bit here.
It's going to
be
Lama.
I could go to Lama. It's very true. I used to live on Lantau, actually. That was as close as I got to tropic. But you know, it's going to be hot and humid. And but I'm, you know, if we can be stuck in an AC office for, you know, the majority of it, that could be worse.
Well,
yeah.
No more news cycles, right? The news never sleeps. And with the global readership for the SCMP, someone's always reading.
Sure, absolutely,
yeah.
Yes. No,
the
they are. Which is either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it.
So, Peter, I'm wondering, you know, do photographers share stories like fishermen, you know, the one that got away? Do you have a story like that?
Well, we don't usually share them on podcasts, I can assure you. But it's not one that got away, but one that eluded, more like. So The sailing event, the Tokyo Olympics, was held in Enoshima Bay, a very beautiful place in Ito Province, and it sits at the foot of Mount Fuji. Well, you can see Mount Fuji from the bay, very beautiful. But being the summer, it's always shrouded in cloud. You can very rarely see it. But one of my colleagues and friends, Clive Mason from Getty Images, in fact he's having his sailing exhibition when the Olympics are on in the club upstairs, he got there much earlier than anyone else, and he got some beautiful pictures of sailboats with Mount Fuji in the background. Very beautiful. So we all went there going, oh, did you see Clive's picture? It's going to be great. Look at that. I was there for 10 days, didn't see Mount Fuji once. Oh, not once. And then I left from Enoshima to go to the track cycling event, which is the other side of the bay. So I had another view of Mount Fuji. My first morning in my hotel, I woke up, drew the curtains, and there she was, Mount Fuji in all her glory, with the sewage farm in the front, in the foreground, but still, it was there. So it eluded me for 10 days at the sailing, but she finally came out for the cycling.
Okay, well, Peter, you know, I'm going to turn to technology because we're always interested in how technology disrupts and transforms mm-hmm. industries, including yours.
Yes.
And we've all seen what generative AI can do, both with Photoshop, but as well, amazing videos. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, how has technology or has technology changed what you do as a photographer?
Massively, especially in sports photography, because the volume of pictures you generate is huge. I mean, even when I started shooting film, and I mean, my first soccer game I ever shot was, I think it was Kitchi versus, what else would there be?
Kitchi. Eastern, Lehman, Eastern or Rangers.
Up in Mongkok Stadium, you know, on a manual 300mm lens, a Nikon F3 with no motor drive. And film, you know, you'd use 1600 ASA film pushed to 3200 and the lighting was terrible. To now where we have cameras which can shoot, you know, 100 frames a second, and we transmit in live, you know, we can transmit our pictures to an editor as we shoot them. You know, it's, you know, we've gone from one extreme to the absolute other. But of course, the middle of that is perfect. It's made our jobs very much easier. And the advent of autofocus also has made, I wouldn't say it's made the job easier, because actually what it's done is made, with manual focus, if you've got a really nice sharp picture coming towards you, then it's a great photo. Now with autofocus, that's just a very dull photo. Autofocus, it made you get much, much better images. The quality of images went up, and so it's a massive benefit.
So you're a pro, but I'm amazed at how mainstream even the technology has gotten. I mean, we won't go into this story, but the a member of the royal family having photoshopped a certain picture, mm-hmm. how quickly the mainstream sleuths pick this up, not even the pros necessarily.
Yeah.
Maybe the mistakes were so glaringly obvious, but I think that technology has changed the way that we ourselves as ordinary people, not professional photographers sure. like you, you know, well, look at and take pictures.
I think digital manipulation of images is something which, because of, there are so many pictures going out on Instagram and Facebook every day. Whenever an agency like ours picks up a photo from the Royal Family is a source, of course, but we still have to be careful, as noted. But if we're picking photos up from stringers around the world, that's like part-time photographers, we have to be very careful, and they have to make sure that they haven't been touched.
I had a picture editor who said that there was a difference between a picture and a photograph, and I assume that's what Peter's talking about, is that the photograph is that instant in time when they've taken it, whereas, you know, the picture is somewhere where they've added a touch of colour or manipulated it slightly, and then it's not the photo, it's something else.
Things with the advent of social media and stuff, that it's just made agencies like ours much more aware of image manipulation, because it can be, you have to have a reputation in this industry, and we have an extremely good reputation, and one photo could kill all that, you know. This is the reality of the situation.
Yeah, trust is a very a commodity in short supply these days, I think, across a lot of industries. So I'm going to round it up. I know we could talk for a few more hours about this. I'm going to ask both of you to think about what will be the sports to watch at the Olympics this year and why. And if you could also talk a little bit about any stories that are brewing in the background that we should know about that might have an impact. And of course, we're talking about geopolitical happenings. Josh, I'm going to turn to you then. I mean, you're the story man here. As you know, in 1956 Olympics, there was an incident in the water polo match with Hungary versus USSR after a very unpleasant geopolitical happening. Do you think we're going to see anything similar to this at this year's Olympics?
I know that's a good question. I mean, the IOC are in the process of vetting the Russian and Belarusian athletes to see how many of them are actually allowed to compete. There was some suggestion that there might only be allowed to be 44 of them, because obviously some governing bodies have banned them altogether, so they can't compete in some events. Obviously, there's been instances in the tennis over the last 18 months where, you know, tennis decided that everybody could just compete and people aren't shaking hands and aren't talking to each other. Whether that will be intensified by there being a gold medal on the line or something else, then you don't know. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? The gut instinct is always to say, well, they just shouldn't be allowed to compete. And the IOC laughingly claims that it's non-political, which is, you know, ridiculous, because they're the most political organisation out there. But that's so. Yeah, I mean, it'll be Israel too, obviously. Also, I think it's going to be fascinating to see the reaction that those athletes get from the fans. I mean, you know, the French are definitely not backwards in coming forwards when it's about when they want to make their feelings known on things. So I think that that will be. You could find that it's quite a hostile environment for some of them, and seeing how they cope with that will be interesting. But away from all the, you know, geopolitical stuff, I really want to see, from a personal point of view, I really want to see what the rugby sevens is like, because France have drafted in Antoine Dupont, who's largely considered to be one of the best players in the world, if not the best. And so just watching him play is going to be amazing, and see how they do, because he changes their team entirely. So obviously you're not going to get away from the 100 metres, because that's the blue ribboned event and everybody wants to watch it. I will be interested to see what happens in the marathon, especially you know, given everything that's happened. I think that see who comes out of the pack and wins that now. And will they get anywhere close to 2 hours? I don't think so. I don't think they will, but you never know.
Yep.
So yeah, those are definitely storylines worth watching.
And neither of you guys mentioned breakdancing. I am so disappointed. Seriously.
It's not a sport.
Well, tell that to someone else, because apparently there are competitions for
it. Well, you can be a competition, but it doesn't make it a sport.
Okay, Peter, Josh, and Jarrett, thank you so much. This has been fascinating. And as you can hear, the table behind is still having lots of fun at lunchtime. Whoever drinks at lunch, who knew? But I think now we deserve a drink. So let's call it a day. And thank you for sharing your memories.
Thank you.
Thank
Christine.
You, guys. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's all for this edition of The Correspondent, the podcast of the Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong. Don't forget, you can keep in touch with our lunchtime Q&A sessions and interviews on our YouTube channel. Just search for FCC Hong Kong. There you can find everything and everyone, from Noam Chomsky talking Trump and democracy, to author Eric Lee talking about the Chinese Communist Party and a world beyond liberalism. You can find conversations with Maria Ressa, Chris Patton, as well as the panel discussion on Article 23 with Regina Ip and Chair of the Hong Kong Journalist Association, Ronson Chan. We're on most of your social channels like LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just search for FCCHK. Our next edition, we'll be talking much more about the upcoming FCC conference in May. You can find out more on that on our socials and on our website at fcchk.org. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.